Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Dr. John Endres. John, how are you doing?
Mr.'s good. I'm good, and you? Thanks, Nick. Good to be back on the show.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't ever get to say doctor. It's much more fun, so I'm going to say doctor.
We're coming to ask about your knee next.
It reminds me of a joke, but I don't have time to tell it now. And I'm also joined today with Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Well, thank you. And equally as pleased as you are to be in the company of our CEO. And from a sort of a rainy early autumnal day in Cape Town, I'm pleased to say, nice and cool. Bit of thunder even, which is rare for us.
Yeah. Indeed. And may I take this opportunity to describe our glorious CEO as not only a handsome man, but a powerful man.
But also merciful, Nick. Also merciful.
Oh, yes, man. Merciful. Yes. Never forget merciful. But speaking of handsome and powerful men, let's talk about our first story today. And Jacob Zuma, the ANC is starting to express publicly some regrets about the way they handled the Zuma era. We've already seen Fikile Mbalula's outburst a couple of months ago, saying that, essentially admitting that the ANC had known they were lying very deliberately on Zuma's behalf to protect him over the Nkandla scandal. And now the ANC's election head, Ndumesi Ntuli, has said that, we probably made a bit of a mistake by supporting Zuma so aggressively. We had a bit of an oops. He said he said that by supporting Zuma so aggressively through the courts and in parliament, that he had put himself above the organization and his brand had been put above the organization to the detriment of the ANC. He said, quote, "While one may not take away the good things that were achieved during his tenure as leader of the party in the ANC government, these are his achievements and the ANC's, but there are many things which are very strange that were done during that era, which were never dealt with while Jay-Z was still in the ANC. Some of these were revealed through the Commission of Inquiries and other investigations. Now there is evidence that Tom Moyane, until his contract was terminated by President Cyril Ramaphosa, and Dudu Mayeni and others took conscious and deliberate actions with the aim of walloping and hollowing these state-owned enterprises." At the same time, the ANC has found itself in a little bit of a bind because recently they had this high-profile resignation of their, I think he was the deputy leader of the Veterans League. He was promised, Vuso Msimang, and he was promised that he wouldn't have to resign as long as the ANC excluded from its parliamentary lists people who were found to have a case to answer by the Zondo Commission's investigation into state capture. The ANC is now kind of getting close to the time where it has to submit the electoral lists, and it's a little bit awkward because included in the number of people who have been found to be, shall we say, having a case to answer, are people like Gweda Mantashe, the Minister of Mineral Resources, Energy, and the ANC National Chairperson, Zizu Kodwa, the Minister of Sports, Art, and Culture, David Mahlobo, the Deputy Minister of Water and Sanitation, also the Minister in the Presidency, Nomvula Makanyane, who is the First Secretary General of the ANC, a number of ANC members who, in the Daily Maverick story on this, a guy called Bongani Bongo, simply has numerous allegations placed next to his name. That's because I believe he has been charged or at some point was arrested in connection with the murder of his wife, Malusi Gigaba. So let's just say that if the ANC did stick to this promise to its to Simang, that it would be excluding a rather large percentage of its senior leadership from parliament. John, let me start with you. It really does seem like the ANC is in a kind of endless nightmare from which it cannot awake. It just can't seem to get a good story these days, no matter what it does.
Yeah, Nick, it's, I think, you know, we were trying to anticipate what the ANC's election campaign was going to be about. And I think we got most of the calls right. There'd be quite a bit of revolutionary nostalgia harking back to the glory days of liberation. The achievements of the early administration. But one of the problems that the ANC faces in its electoral campaigning is the many allegations and sometimes even sentences for corruption and other crimes against ANC members. Was it Cyril Ramaphosa who acknowledged that the ANC was considered as accused number one in terms of corruption? So that's a problem if you're running an election campaign, and then, of course, you have to do something about it. So somebody's got to go out there and say sorry for all of these things. And that's a bit of what we're seeing now, where these ANC people are going out to the media and giving interviews, apologizing for all the misdeeds, the missteps, the underperformance of the past years, in the hopes that the electorate will once again forgive them and trust them with their vote. But it is hard. I think this is a hard gig to have as an ANC member. Mdumiseni Ntuli is the guy who's now on the job. He has to do it. But I also wonder if voters are going to go for it. They've heard the story many times before. Before each election, there's the apologies, but it doesn't really seem to do anything very much. Nick.
All right. Michael, this is not the kind of headline you want to see going into an election. But I think it's sort of one of the things that is so damaging about this in particular, their admitting of mistakes in the Jacob Zuma era, is how it has laid the party's sort of moral authority just completely destroyed. It's just shredded it completely. Essentially, now that they've been forced to admit that it really was all just a cynical transactional defense and all of that stuff about, I remember all of the rhetoric that was going around when Zuma and the Nkandla scandal was flying around this is all a plot by white monopoly capital and this is counter-revolutionary forces and all that. And it's kind of just all been exposed as a load of hot air.
Yeah. And all credit to Chris McKaya of Daily Maverick, the story that we're referring to, I think, today. I think it is yesterday, actually, a story from yesterday. Party should never have put Zuma's interests above its own, says ANC elections head. All credit to Chris McKay for pointing out that, in fact, Mdumiseni Ntuli was, during Zuma's tenure, was the provincial secretary of the ANC in the KZN when fraud and corruption charges were laid against or leveled against Zuma, or were reinstated, actually. And McKay points out that Ntuli was one of the leaders who supported him in court and in public. So this is always going to be the ANC's problem. It's always going to have to be confronting a behavior that has a history. And the thing that I see most clearly in it, and to my mind, it actually goes quite a bit further back than Jacob Zuma, all the way back to the late 1990s, is this overweening impulse to, or inclination to, always put the party before the country. The party always came first. Unfortunately, Nelson Mandela was guilty of it too. I remember instances covering it as a reporter and thinking to myself, he shouldn't be saying these things as the president of the country. He's putting the party ahead of the rest of us and ahead of the kind of national interest. And I think this is really what we're seeing. And of course, now 2024, it's the consequences are becoming all the more burdensome and all the more visible, palpable. People are feeling the consequences as a burden on their shoulders. It's a financial burden. It's the burden of opportunities or lost opportunities and so on. That it's becoming very pressing for the ANC to have to deal with this. It can't run away from it. It has to deal with it. And it's not a good look. I think I liked your characterization, this endless nightmare from which it cannot awake. I think this is it. You know, it wakes up and the reality kind of hits it in the face and it tries to maybe go to sleep again and the nightmare recurs. So it's a very difficult one. And it's going to be, yeah. I mean, I think some people will once more forgive them, maybe. We'll be forgiving, we'll be... probably unduly lenient, but, you know, for all sorts of other complicated reasons that have so much to do with our history and our current politics. But I think we are seeing the ANC feeling a greater discomfort perhaps than they've ever felt before.
It also makes the renewal message. So this was Cyril Ramaphosa's bid coming in, saying it's a new leaf, it's a new South Africa, it's a new dawn. We're distancing ourselves from all of these missteps of the past. But now here we are 5-6 years later, and it's still the same problems being talked about. They haven't been resolved.
Yeah.
I got my wires a bit crossed earlier. I confused Bongani Bongo and Sibusiso Kula. Sibusiso Kula was the ANC MP charged with the murder of his wife. And I see, actually, he was removed from Parliament in October, which I didn't notice at the time. But it is kind of fascinating, however, to see that the ANC is still sort of holding up in the polling. And I do wonder whether these scandals are really going to be able to be properly used by the opposition to take the ANC apart before the election, because, you know, as you say, that the new dawn thing has now been so sort of shredded that it's kind of really difficult to come forward with a credible message, because it's been heard all before. And I guess, in a sense, credible messages are the theme of this podcast today. Let's move on to our next story. And this is about the failure of one of South Africa's new opposition parties, which didn't really get off the ground very far. This was started by former First Rand chair, Roger Jardine, who started an organization called Change Starts Now. Received a bit of media buzz. It got reportedly some significant amounts of funding from a number of wealthy individuals. And it was characterized by some in the media as being this kind of, more business friendly, more credible opposition alternative to parties like the DA or the IFP. And it launched very recently. I believe it was last week. But it didn't seem to last very long. The whole thing fell apart, and on Thursday, Jardine pulled out of it, saying that the registration rules for smaller parties were unfair, that the IEC had laid down. So that suggests to me that they were not going to be able to ensure that they got the number of signatures they needed in order to start a political party, which seems a little bit amateur hour, to be quite frank. Michael, what do you make of this story? You know, it's not the first time we've seen an opposition party kind of stumble, although usually it doesn't happen this quickly.
Yeah, I think there's this quite likable aspect to so much of our politics, where you see people coming out of the woodwork and they are, imbued with kind of wonderful sentiments. They love the country. They think the country is great, and they always say the people are great, and we've got a great future. If only we could just work together and do things better, and so on. But
a former colleague of mine described there as being sort of two types of people who get interested in politics. She called one group, I think, Barockas. They sort of slowly fizz away, and then the other group are Enos. They go whoosh.
That's fantastic. It's sort of fizzy, wave of judging, judging our politics, the effervescence or not of, and I mean that's a very, very good metaphor actually, because enthusiasm isn't enough, and well-meaning sentiments are not enough. What we need, and I mean, John's the author of our various iterations of our growth report, and he's looked at these things very, very closely. It's been a part of the sort of IRR's research and analytical DNA for many years. We look at the nuts and bolts of what needs to happen and what can be done, as John has repeatedly said, inexpensively and relatively simply. All it takes is political cojones, or whatever the expression is. You've got to have balls to do it. You've got to have a determination that this is really what you're going to do, and you get on and do it. But it's based on not just ephemeral sort of sentiment. And we have plenty of sentiment in the IRR. I think, I mean, having joined the IRR in 2017, I don't think I've, in my previous 40 years as a journalist, met as many people who are as invested in a better South Africa as I've met in the IRR. And that's, you know, that says something. But it's not simply a flim-flam sentimental issue for IRR researchers. It's a question of looking at what is going to work, what's going to achieve the best results for the most people. We do it in the face of accusations that either we are alarmist or we right-wing or all the whole gamut of accusations that are leveled at us from various critics. And we continue because we are convinced and we can demonstrate that we are really grappling with the practical issues. And that, unfortunately, is not what the amateur enthusiasts generally show themselves to do. They're the opposite. And to me, the real deficiency, in a way, or the consequential shortcoming with outfits like that is actually the backers, the people who've got the money and spend it on the wrong things, the wrong people who are not in the game. They're not in the game because they don't have solid thinking, good ideas, practical suggestions, and that real kind of conviction in South Africa's future that I think is vitally important.
Right. And another missing element, I think, is also just kind of political skill, which is not a sort of straightforward thing. It's like a way of relating to the public in a strategic but honest way that makes it, well, not necessarily honest way, but in a strategic way that also comes across as genuine. And people are often quite good at detecting when you're not being genuine, which is why some politicians fall on their face. Now, I will say that I never really took Change Starts Now that seriously.
Yeah.
Despite the funding and stuff, I don't think they were. That's why we haven't covered them on the show actually until now. So I went to just quickly check out their website to see if it was still up, and it is. Account suspended. The website you're trying to reach is currently unavailable, which is pretty fast actually, considering that it only fell apart on Thursday. Mm. But John, when I was a politician, I'd meet particularly business people who would say things to me like, no, why can't we just fix everything? Like, if we just put someone in there who's like a good manager, we must just find someone who can be like a, sometimes they say, oh, and there must be a popular figurehead, or maybe we just find someone who's good at business, and then he'll just be able to sort everything out. And that seems to me to be at least a little bit of the impetus behind this, the Change Starts Now initiative. But just like that isn't really a solution, I think Change Starts Now was never really a solution. What do you make of this?
I think one of the main lessons I draw from this story is the difference between long-term thinking and short-term thinking. Mm. And I think, we tend to want quick solutions. We're looking for magic bullets. And I think that business people are as prone to that as the rest of society is. And the greater the pressure gets and the worse things look, the more we look for short-term solutions and we look for quick fixes. And I suspect that this was a very large part of the motivation of the backers of Change Starts Now, that they said, we can't live for another 5 years with the kind of administration that we've got now. We need a new administration, a new leadership. We've got little time. What can we do? Well, we'll substitute time for money. We'll just throw money at it and we'll solve the problem. And unfortunately, that's not what works, right? So you really need to do the hard slog. You need the long preparation to get these very massive societal shifts to happen. Societies and politics have a lot of inertia. It's like an oil tanker that you're trying to turn around. It takes a long time. Can't just hit the brakes and expect to stop. And I think that was the mistake here. The hope was that you could, through the infusion of a very large amount of money, shift things in a very short time. But you can't do it that way. You do actually have to do the hard work. And that also reminds me a little bit of the IRR's history, which, is going on 100 years, founded in 1929, has had to take that very long view. Imagine if you were a researcher at the IRR in 1948, the Nats have just won, apartheid is being introduced. You get a funder that says, no, we have to stop that immediately, throws money at it. You're not going to stop it that quickly. You have to do the long slog. You have to do the research, the thinking about it, the understanding of what is going on, what is motivating people if you want to change things. And here, in terms of backers, I think the role of the Oppenheimers should be mentioned, who did take a very long view back in the times of apartheid. I think supported the IRR as well, and did so not in the expectation of, you know, a turnaround within the next 3 months. Their expectation was to say, well, you've got to continue drip feeding liberal ideas into the bloodstream of the body politic if you want to shift things. And it's going to take a long time. And it did, but it worked in the end. And so if there's any funders listening to this, I would encourage you to take the long view and back organizations that also take the long view. That is what really shifts things. It's not the short-term thinking. Nick?
No, exactly right. Changing the public debate is a very difficult and complicated process that takes a very long time. And the sort of impetus to fly in and, you know, as you say, the silver bullets. I think that one of the best pieces of political wisdom I've ever actually heard was, I was listening to a conservative American radio talk show host. And he said, you know, there's this endless search by people of all political orientations on the left and the right and the extreme and the moderate to find the silver bullet. You know, one legal case, one little fact, one little connection they can just make somewhere, and it's just going to make all of the people standing in their way fall away, and they'll win eternal victories and everything will be lovely. And it never ever works out. It always drives people mad or makes them depressed or ends up wasting people's time and barking up the wrong tree. And it's only by the slow slog of influencing the public debate that things actually do change in a different direction. Yeah. Michael, do you have any
just a few thoughts. I liked John's highlighting the fact that, you know, one of the good things we see reflected in these organizations coming to the fore is the sense of urgency. And I think that has certainly gripped the public's imagination. We do need to do something. We can't dilly-dally. Let's get cracking. So there's something positive there. It's just how you do it is important. And the other thing is the idea that, partly picking up on what you mentioned, Nick, is that, you know, politics is much more a process than a product. It's an ongoing thing. It doesn't achieve something tomorrow and then, you know, everything is sublime and we're on a plateau of, you know, sunlit uplands and so on. It's every single day. You've got to engage with this thing, and it's also, I mean, as a society, we've got to engage with people we disagree with entirely. We've got to take them with us also. So there's also that to bear in mind. And then just finally, the point that John was saying, that one hopes that these backers are not simply going to be disappointed and go away, but actually, as Peter Bruce very perceptively noted in his piece, I think yesterday, that it'd be very important, it'd be much more efficacious and positive for them to find somebody else who can actually carry the good ideas and carry the pressure and so on, precisely because it is urgent and precisely because it is a process. So, yeah, let's hope that that's going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's very... very, very much the case. And the Americans are quite a good example of this. You know, when their favorite candidate in a primary fails or their favorite initiative through Congress doesn't really work out, they don't sort of take the soccer ball and go home. They do usually say, okay, now we're going to find the next best thing that we can give our resources to.
Yeah, it's a good analogy. Yeah.
Okay, now we're going to talk a little bit about an editorial written in the Business Day about the ANC's election manifesto and what it says for the country's economic prospects going forward. And this editorial is very damning on what the ANC promised in its election manifesto. It says that the ANC's manifesto contained, quote, no fresh thinking about how to lift growth, it barely mentions economic growth at all. And while it does prioritize unemployment, the only things it can come up with as ways to actually increase employment of South Africans is to spend taxpayers' money to create temporary jobs through government programs, or get the private sector to do it as some part of national effort or some other kind of like vague patriotic idea with unclear parameters. John, I must say, it's very nice to see a significant newspaper endorsing many of the things that we've been saying.
Yeah, so we've made this very much a focus of our work for this year, that being economic growth and how do you get it. And my position is that no party should be in power in South Africa that doesn't have a credible path to growth for the economy. And looking at the various election manifestos, really, I think the results have been quite mixed. I think we can be safe in assuming that the EFF policies, if implemented, would not lead to economic growth, but rather the opposite. And in the case of the ANC, because they are proposing more of the same thing that they've been doing for the past 30 years, I think we would also not be getting growth. And that is a real problem. So how do you get economic growth? I was speaking to an investment manager this morning who was quizzing me quite intensively about what needs to happen. And really, I think the main thing that needs to happen is that you need to get investment going. Our investment levels are at 14.2% of GDP. That was in 2022, when the world average is 26, and emerging markets are higher than 26. And if you're not investing money into your infrastructure, your machinery, your equipment, all of the things that you need to make stuff and ship stuff to customers, then the economy is not going to grow. That has to be number one. And the state has limited capacity to invest more because it is spending so much on consumption, so on salaries and procuring goods and services, but very little on investment. The private sector does have a lot of resources available, several trillion rand available to invest in South Africa, but which it is unwilling to do because the investment conditions are so unattractive. And this is where what Michael was saying earlier comes in. Like, if you want to shift that equation, you can do it rather inexpensively. You just have to eliminate the threats to property rights and make it attractive for investors to put their money in to the South African economy and encourage them to reap the rewards. And then you can really spark high levels of growth. But that's what needs to happen. Nick.
Michael, what do you make of this?
I think just to pick up on the theme of John's, what John's been saying, and the editorial in Business Day, their very final paragraph deals with something that we've made a campaign quite that I think people identify with the IRR, and that is the campaign against prescribed assets. And this is a case where, as I was referring earlier to critics calling us alarmist, this was, 4 or 5 years ago, it prescribed assets reared its head, and we spoke up immediately about it, warned of the consequences. And at that time, people said, no, you're making too much of this. This is alarmist. This is, you know, this is fear-mongering. And lo and behold, in 2024, we see in the election manifesto, prescribed assets comes up again. And the point, that, as John has just said, you know, that if state-owned enterprises were run properly, and were sound investments, there plenty of people would want to invest in them. A good solid investment in a well-run project is something that asset managers and others would very willingly go for, but they wouldn't have to be coerced into doing so. But it would have to be a guaranteed investment. I think there was a case, our colleague Maurice Reuters often mentioned this, Cape Town floated a bond to fund an energy project, and I think it was oversubscribed 4 times because its fundamentals were trustworthy and people could see, investors could see, this is something we would make money out of. It's not, they're not doing it out of the goodness of their hearts, and one doesn't want that in an economy. You want an economy to function on the basis that people are getting benefits at every level. And so this is a succinct case of exactly what we're talking about. Instead of stepping back, focusing on the things that they should be doing well and doing them well, they are trying to coerce citizens into being part of a state-run enterprise, which is not being effective.
Exactly right. John, any final thoughts before we close up for today?
Yeah, one final thought here is that I do think we're not mistaken in observing a shift in the narrative. Mm-hmm. I think that the media, what you see on social media as well, is beginning to realize that without growth, you're not going to make stuff work and you've got to figure out a way. I think there's still a lot of casting about for solutions on how to do this. But at least we're beginning to recognize that redistribution by itself is not going to solve the problems. Yes, you do need to get the growth going in order to fix the country. And I think that's quite encouraging. You know, we've got political contestation, lots of parties coming up. Let them each make their pitch on how they would achieve growth and then, you know, succeed or fail on those terms.
And, you know, so I've been doing some research on India recently, and one of the things that really strikes me about that place is that it's kind of the living proof that you really don't need to get everything or even necessarily most things right in order to start seeing a change in the direction of your country. As long as you get some of those fundamentals about not just trying to stamp on the throat of business all the time correct, you will actually see economic growth. You will actually see, a change in unemployment rate. You'll see a lot of new resources and development in the society because, you know, despite government's best efforts, in many cases, people do make a plan, and people can often see the potential of a developing economy, not just local investors but foreign investors. And as long as they believe that they will probably get a profit and that their stuff is very unlikely to be taken away. And that they won't be completely destroyed by some sort of arbitrary regulation or be taken down for a bribe. Investors will take a shot at things, improving things. And that's why India has 7% economic growth and we're sitting at less than 1. It's not because they do everything right. It's because they do enough right. And I think, as a country, we're beset by many problems. Maybe we should start by at least doing some things right. And then presumably we can work our way up to getting most things right. That would be nice. Okay. Thank you very much for watching. I hope that you all found the show interesting. And we will see you next week. Sorry, tomorrow. I'm very muddled today. Apologies. On the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.